I felt kind of vindicated, and I thought, well, obviously readers are enjoying it, so the publishers, you know, for all their reticence and thinking that this audience would not like it, they were wrong.
Hello and welcome to In Writing with me, Hattie Crissell. The voice that you heard there was that of Amar Anwar. I came across Amar because he's an alumnus of the Creative Writing MA that I'm currently doing at Birkbeck, and he took part in an event for my course mates last term. When I heard his story, I really felt that he would be brilliant for the podcast, and he didn't disappoint. Amar writes crime thrillers with a difference. The difference being that unlike the vast majority of similar books published in the UK, Amar's are set in the British Asian community. So there are gangsters, there are drug deals, there are murders. It's just that the characters all happen to be Asian, and the backdrop is the London area of Southall. The main reason that I was really keen to get Amar on the podcast is that his road to getting published has been as full of intrigue and twists and turns as one of his books. He actually self-published his first novel before it later found a home at Dialogue Books. And if anyone out there is thinking about self-publishing, then I would say this is a masterclass in how to do it well. I don't know if I've heard such a cunning and well-executed plan from a real-life person before, and hearing about it made me definitely understand how Amar writes those crime plots. I interviewed Amar in September at his home, which is not far from the location of his novels in West London. He lives with family, and he showed me in, made me a cup of tea, cracked open the Jaffa cakes, and took me up to his very tidy bedroom, which is where he writes. Before we get started with that, I'm happy to say that this week's episode of In Writing is sponsored by Curtis Brown Creative, the writing school affiliated to the major literary agency. Since launching in 2011, over 140 of their students have gone on to get major book deals, including the best-selling crime authors Jane Harper, Kaz Freer, Anna Bailey, and Laura Marshall. They offer a wide range of online writing courses led by acclaimed authors and industry insiders, including their popular six-week genre-led courses. There's Writing a Psychological Thriller with best-selling author Erin Kelly, which starts this month, and Writing Crime Fiction with award-winning novelist Fasim Khan, which starts in February next year. Both those courses are open now for enrolment, and they feature exclusive teaching videos and writing tasks, plus the opportunity to get individual feedback from one of Curtis Brown Creative's expert fiction editors. Visit curtisbrowncreative.co.uk to find out more about all their current courses. And I'm also pleased to say that Curtis Brown Creative have provided an exclusive discount for listeners of this podcast. Use the code INWRITING20 for £20 off the short online writing course of your choice. And by doing that, you'll also be supporting the podcast. I'll give you that code again at the end, but for now, over to Amar.
Describe the room, first of all, for people listening.
Okay, it's mostly bookshelves, stuffed with books, a very small desk with an Apple Mac computer and monitor, a couple of wardrobes, a bed, and more books.
Yeah. Very, very tidy books. And you were saying before that you have some sort of catalogue system for these books. Talk me through that.
Well, I had so many books, and I think it stems from when, I'm sure everyone's done this, when you buy a repeat copy of something you've already got, and then you find out, oh, I've already got that. So I thought, well, I need to keep on top of what I've bought, because it's all over the place, and it's in bags and boxes, and before I had the bookshelves. So there was this app called Library Thing, and you can just put load your books into it and catalogue it, and it has all sorts of info. And because these shelves are too deep, so what you can see, there's another row of books behind everything that you can see. So there's books that I can't even see, so I don't know. If I was to look for something, I wouldn't know where it is. So I've catalogued them all on the computer with a kind of, it isn't quite Dewey Decimal, but it's my own little system, so I can look it up and I'll know exactly where a book is, and then I can find it if I need it to, or if I want to read it or something.
So it would literally be like third bookshelf along, second row back, sort of thing.
Yeah, like sixth shelf down, at the back, and so yeah, I could probably find anything now.
That's very impressive. And did you say it calculates how long it would take you to read?
No, that was me.
Oh, that was
you. I was basing it on like an average, and this is when I was sort of commuting every day as well. So because I'd read on the tube a lot, and like I was averaging about a book a week or something. So at that, you know, I tried to work out how long it would take me to get through my TBR pile, and this was going back a while. And at a rough estimate, it would have taken me about 10 years. And I've bought a lot more books since then. And now I get sent proofs and stuff like that. So that figure has just gone out of the windows. And I have no idea. I mean, I shudder to think, really. But, you know, it's really nice to have all of these books here. And I look at them and all the potential stories that there are there for me to read. I'm just it keeps me excited. And I think, oh, I want to read that one and that one and that one.
Yeah. Are there particular writers who have been inspiring to you in your work?
Oh, massively, yes. So I think the book that made me want to become a writer is a fantasy novel I read in my teens called Magician. It's by an author called Raymond E. Feist. And I remember I finished that book and it kind of had everything. You know, there was like sword fights and dragons and this, that. And it made me laugh. It sort of kept me gripped, excited. There was like really shocking bits, really sad bits. And, you know, I remember how it ended. And it was such a perfect ending. And I think I must have welled up just a little because it was just so perfect. And that ending, the way he ended that book, inspired how I ended Brothers in Blood. That
really?
I mean, it's very subtle. I mean, I don't think you could sort of, you know, really kind of see it, but for me it was definitely inspired by that. And then I think in crime, the writers that have really inspired me, as you might be able to see them up on the bookshelf, actually there's a lot of Elmore Leonard novels there.
Mm-hmm.
And I absolutely love Elmore Leonard. That he's the writer who got me into crime fiction. And then there's Richard Stark's Parker novels, which are all about a professional bank robber. They're fantastic. And Joe R. Lansdale, who writes the Happ and Leonard series, and also Walter Mosley, because he wrote the first sort of black character of color, that I'd sort of read in crime fiction, who was the main character. And I think that sort of showed me that, you know, it was possible to have characters of color be the main characters in those sorts of books. I read Devil in a Blue Dress and I was like, oh my God, that's so interesting. And it was the setting as well. It was that part of LA after the Second World War. It was the black community and how he couldn't go, like, or they couldn't go to the regular police, one, because they didn't trust them and because of racism. And I thought, wow, that's very similar to the atmosphere and the feel of like places that I know, and especially like Southall, which went on to become the setting of my first novel. So that was a real eye opener. And then Elmore Leonard, his main characters aren't always sort of like your classical police detective or private eye. So sometimes it's the criminal who's the main character, and sometimes it's just an ordinary person who gets caught up in sort of criminal activity. And that again spoke to me because I didn't know anything about the police or, you know, being a private eye. I didn't have that sort of background. And so just being able to write the ordinary kind of characters who get caught up in that sort of stuff, I thought, well, I could do that. Yeah. And then I started looking at the sort of people I was hearing about, the stories I was hearing about in Southall, and just kind of people I knew. And I thought, well, they'd be quite fun to write about. They'd be really good in a crime thriller. And that sort of got the wheels turning.
Yeah.
In that respect.
Are you writing anything at the moment?
I should be. I'm working. Let's say I'm planning the third Zack and Jags book at the moment.
Okay, that's exciting.
Yeah.
So when you are working on something, because I know you've got a full-time job on as well as your writing.
Yeah.
So how do you work your writing around that?
With difficulty. Mm-hmm. I think the trick is just finding any sort of pockets of time and writing. When I started writing Brothers in Blood, I was working full-time. And then I just started doing an MA in creative writing and moved house. And then my daughter was born as well. So there was just loads.
That is a lot.
There's loads going, which sort of explains why it took so long to write. Because I think from start to finish, Brothers in Blood was 8 years. And yeah, so that was a long time. And there was periods in that where I sort of for a year or 2 years just didn't write hardly anything because I just didn't have the time. You know, I'd be working all the way across town, and then the commute would take an hour and a half or something each way. So that's why I got a lot of reading done, but I didn't get a lot of writing done. You know, I'd come home and I'd be knackered and then have to sort of just do sort of, you know, eat and spend some time with my daughter and then, you know, repeat the whole thing again. So yeah, it was quite difficult, but I always had the urge to, you know, I wanted to finish the book. So if you really want to do it, you can find time, and it might not be a lot of time. It was really, for me, it was late nights and weekends, and that was it. And not every weekend, because then, you know, life gets in the way. You have parties, you have to go out with, you know, friends and just do other stuff as well, just to keep sane, I think. But yeah, I think I was quite driven, and I had, you know, I had the end in sight, and for me that was to finish the book.
So when you were working on, say, Stone Cold Trouble, which was your book that came out last year, your second Zach and Jags book.
Yes, indeed.
What, talk me through a little bit what your kind of routine was with writing, and when were you sitting down, and how do you, during those writing sessions, how are you approaching that?
Yeah, so you see, my life's a bit of a roller coaster in that respect. So, okay, when I started writing Brothers in Blood, just to go back for a second, so I was working full time and I was doing the MA and everything. But about, about a year or so into the MA, I got made redundant. So I got a bit of money there. And then I thought, you know what? This is kind of a blessing in disguise. I'll take some time off and just work on the book. So I did that. I did that for a few months. And then I thought, I'm really enjoying this, being able to just sort of focus on the book. But I'm running out of money, so I need to do something else. So I applied for an Arts Council grant and I got it.
Amazing.
So then that funded me for like another 6 months. So I managed to get quite a lot done. And then I just sort of kind of eked out the grant money for as long as I could. And then I got a part-time job so I could sort of continue. And then I think my wife went on maternity leave. So then I had to get a full-time job. And so that was one of the periods where I didn't write much. And then I became a stay-at-home dad for a while. So then I would write when my daughter went down for her morning nap. When she was really young, she'd sleep for 2 hours. So I was like, right, I've got 2 hours in the day. And I would just write and then spend the rest of the day with her. And then when she went to bed, then maybe write again in the evenings. And then I had to get a full-time job. So then the writing kind of stopped. And with Stone Cold Trouble, I think I'd stopped working again. I'd save up some money and then I'd applied for more grants. And sort of, you know, when I was getting towards the end of that book and I was again running out of funds, then I had, you know, I asked friends if they could help me out. So I, you know, they loaned me some money just to tide me over. And then, you know, now I'm working again. So I've sort of paid, well, most of them back. but yeah, I think, so this book is the first one that I've started and will probably have to start and finish while I'm working full time. So I think it's just going to be back to late evenings and weekends.
Yeah.
But the thing about that is, you know, I love watching films and TV, but when I was working full time, that was it. I had to give up TV basically and movies. And I was so behind. Everyone's talking about, are you watching this? You're watching that. But yeah, you know, something has to give and you have to, you know, to make that time. So
yeah. And so would you, because I think there are probably lots of people who listen to this podcast who are trying to write a novel alongside a full-time job in a different...
I'm one of them.
Yeah, yeah. So would you encourage them to look for those grants and things then? Because that's good to know there is money out there.
There is, yeah. I mean, you have to apply and, you know, it's not guaranteed that you'll get it, but there's different strands and if you make a good enough case, the money is there and it's national lottery funded. So the money's there to be given out. Yeah. So, yeah, it's definitely worth applying. And I tell everybody, you know, any writer I meet who says, oh, you know, I haven't got time to write and this and that. And, you know, if 6 months would help, then, yeah, it's very definitely worth applying to get that time. Because I know just how brilliant it was for me. It just really gave me... And you really feel like a writer then because you've got all day to sort of sit and focus on it. And when you know you've just got a limited amount of time, it helps to focus the mind a bit as well.
Yeah, I think I was just thinking actually in a way that sort of time constraint might be quite useful as well, of knowing like this money is going to run out and I have to make the most of this time.
Yeah, and you kind of appreciate having that time if you haven't had it.
When do you first remember being interested in writing?
I must have been about, I think, 5 or 6, because I remember writing stories at school, at sort of primary school, and I loved it. And I think they got a good reception. And one that I remember very clearly was, I can't remember, was it Ted Hughes or somebody? It was a book about how animals sort of got their names, or a bit about these animals. So I wrote a story about how a rabbit got its name, and it's got big ears, and like the cavemen used to try and catch it, and they would say grab it, and they dropped the G from it, and it became rabbit. And the teachers really loved that story. And I remember just thinking, oh, you know, that was a lot of fun. I had fun writing it, and I just loved the response that it got. So I wrote quite a lot of stories at that young age, you know, just for myself. At that point, I had no, you know, desire or ambition or anything about ever writing a book. But I loved that. But then sort of somewhere after that, I think in the sort of run up to doing what would be now GCSEs, but in my day was O-levels, so that's sort of giving my age away a bit, kind of the creative element of all of that just kind of fell by the wayside. And it wasn't really, I don't remember it ever being encouraged. And so creative writing and fiction writing was something that I kind of stopped doing. And I didn't pick it up until years and years later. But I was always a huge reader, and I was always read. And then, yeah, like when I read Magician, I was just like, I would love to be able to do that. You know, and that really, I mean, the book's called Magician, but it really did feel like sort of magic, because that really got me thinking that someone has just sat there and just put words on paper, and yet those words have conjured this whole world and these images and these emotions. And I was like, that really is magic to be able to do that. And I thought, I'd love to be able to do that. That seemed like, wow, just something really special.
So at what point did you think, right, I'm going to try and write a book?
Well, I think I kind of thought I'd love to do it. And I may have given it a go, and then very quickly thought, there's a reason why I don't think I can write a book. It was really bad. I mean, it was just terrible writing.
That's what happens to everyone when they sit down.
Yeah, but I think I just started, you know, I thought, right, I've got this sort of vague idea. And I sort of wrote the first chapter, or what I thought was the first chapter. And bearing in mind, I was reading people like Elmore Leonard and Walter Mosley. And I was I so wanted to write like them, or, you know, as close to them as I possibly could. So in my head, it would sort of seem like that. But when I read it back, it would be completely different. And so, yeah, then I just sort of thought, well, no, it's not something it's beyond me, is what I thought. But so I've been working in art and design. And this was when sort of the internet was really sort of taking off, and I remember people saying, oh, you know, you can, there's great jobs in web design if you know it. And my background was in print design, and I thought, well, it'd be useful to learn some web design stuff. So I actually started off doing courses in HTML and CSS coding, and then I sort of finished a couple of courses, and I thought, well, I actually quite like doing one evening a week or something, learning something. It's quite nice. After bunking off school all those years when I was young, you know, to actually want to be in a classroom and learn something. And so I was looking for a class to do. I thought, well, what can I do? There were so many classes around. And there just happened to be one that was an introduction to writing fiction. And I thought, oh.
Where was that?
So that was through Hammersmith and Fulham Adult Education.
Right.
And I think I was quite fortunate. It was quite a long course for an introductory course. I think it was something like sort of 20 weeks or something. And it was started off just writing, you know, a 1,000-word stories, which still seemed like quite a lot at that point. Because I'd never written anything that long before. And it was all, you know, you'd get a sort of topic and write a story on this for next week. And then you'd get into the class and you'd read it out. Because it was quite short. And yeah, I remember just kind of, I suppose it just awoke that kind of childhood enjoyment of writing in me. And, you know, I found out, even though it was sort of, I'd sort of spend my weekends doing it, I kind of really enjoyed it and I got quite a lot out of it.
Can I ask how old you were at this point?
I would have been 36.
Okay.
Yeah. And I remember reading them out and they would get quite a good reaction in the class. You know, people would come up afterwards and say, oh, that was really great. It was really, you know, really exciting. So, because they were all kind of action-y kind of stories, because that's what I was really into. They didn't have any literary aspirations, and I don't think there was a lot of poetic language or anything, or purple prose in them, but they kind of, you know, did a job. And the reactions I was getting were the reactions I was hoping for. So that was really good. And that sort of got me thinking, oh, maybe I can write this book then, that had been sort of percolating for 20 years in my head. And I gave it a go, and I still wasn't ready. The writing still wasn't like good enough. But that course finished, and I remember the tutor said, look, if any of you want to take this further, because that course was affiliated with Birkbeck, and he said there was a graduate level, a certificate in creative writing that they used to run at Birkbeck, which I think now is the BA
right
at Birkbeck. And so I thought, well, no, I've done this course. That's my introduction. I can write this book. So I had a couple of stabs at it over the summer break, and no, it wasn't working. And then I didn't write anything. And then I thought, you know what? I need another course just to keep me writing, just to get me doing things, you know, on a weekly sort of basis, having deadlines and stuff. So I applied for that course, got on it, and it was a 2-year course. And at the beginning of the second year, the tutor at the beginning of the year took everyone aside. You had a 5-minute sort of chat with her. And she said to me, so, you know, what do you hope to get out of this year? You know, just so that I suppose she could sort of tailor her teaching. And I said, and I remember, I was very clear about this, I want to write a crime novel. I want to get published. It was very definite. And she was like, okay. you know what you're doing, so why don't you start writing this novel? And I was like, well, I don't think I'm ready. And she said, well, how will you know when you're ready? You know, when will you? And I thought I would just continue writing short stories until I felt ready, but then perhaps I would have put it off forever. And she said, look, you're in this class, you've got a whole year, and you can submit stuff, workshop it, improve it, and by the end of the year you'll have made a start on your novel. You know, you'll have written a good sort of portion of the beginning at least, and then that can help you. And that struck me as very good advice, so I thought, okay, I'll give it a go. And I started writing it, and it was still pants, unfortunately. But
great use of writerly vocab there.
Yes.
Don't hear pants very
but
often.
I realized it was pants, so you know, obviously, you know, I could see that there was something wrong with it, but I couldn't quite work out what it was. And then I thought, no, I need something to inspire me. So I picked up an Elmore Leonard book that I hadn't read before. At that point, there were some that I hadn't read, but now I've read pretty much all of them. And I started reading the book, but really kind of analysing how he did things, like in his dialogue and his structure. And one of the really good, great things he does is that you get inside the head of his characters, and you kind of see, even though it's all written third person, but you're in their heads, and he kind of gives their thoughts, but without you really noticing that he's doing it. It's really good. And so I was like, yeah, I was sort of getting all that. And then I saw the movie Payback with Mel Gibson, and I really liked that because it's a really dark sort of noir kind of crime movie. And I kind of watched that and reading Elmore Leonard, and I had both those influences were right in my head. And I had another go at writing my first chapter, the opening to the book. And then when I read it back for the first time, it wasn't completely pants. I thought,
brilliant.
Yeah. And I think it was getting just the tone and the voice. That's what the issue had been up till that point. And I kind of read it back and I thought, yeah, that's got that kind of feel that I wanted to it. And I workshopped that in the class and I got really good feedback. You know, there was some criticism. I remember the tutor, one of the things she said, if you could get rid of the excess verbiage, it would be quite good. And as a novice writer, yeah, one of the things you do, kind of repeat yourself. And I realized that. And she, you know, there was a lot of places where she'd cross stuff out. You know, you've already told us this, you've already said this. And
right. So just getting better at self-editing. And
exactly, yeah. And also, I think when you're starting out, you kind of wonder, have I explained this fully enough? Will people get this? And then I think as time goes on, and I think I've learned more and more as I've sort of written and rewritten and stuff like that, you kind of give the readers a lot more credit. You don't have to spell everything out. Sometimes not saying something, the readers will fill it in.
I'm doing the MA at Birkbeck at the moment, and there's now a genre module, so you can.
Oh, well, that would have been handy when I was there.
So you didn't have that sort of direct training in sort of how genre fiction works?
I think there was a genre module, but it was just a module. Whereas, you know, nowadays you can do crime writing, a complete MA in crime writing and stuff, but there wasn't anything like that. It was more literary kind of writing focused. And I went in there very much with a genre mindset. I knew I wanted to write a crime novel. So, after I'd done that certificate course, I applied to do the MA just because I found doing classes really useful. And I knew I didn't know enough about writing. I hadn't been writing long enough. I didn't have much experience. You know, I hadn't come from writing for magazines or a blog or anything at all. So I just felt, you know, I needed to soak up as much as I could knowledge wise about writing. So the MA just seemed like a good thing for me to do. And I went on it knowing, because I'd already started writing Brothers in Blood. So I knew I was writing a crime thriller. I knew I wanted to get published. And I think I was the only person on there who was writing genre fiction.
Mm. You know. And just for anybody listening who doesn't know what we're talking about when we say genre fiction, so that in the industry, that these are sort of the terms that are used, that you're either writing literary
commercial
fiction. So it's basically books that sell a lot.
Yeah. Genre tends to sell. So genre would cover science fiction, fantasy, crime, romance, you know, all
historical
the stuff,
fiction, I guess, would be genre.
Yes, definitely. So all the stuff that generally people like to read for enjoyment, and people read literary fiction for enjoyment, but a lot of times people feel that that's what they should be reading because it's somehow
it's sort of seen as a bit more highbrow, isn't it? But genre fiction's like you can get it in W.H. Smith before you get on a flight, and then you can read it on the beach. But it's all a bit. It's all the divisions between these genres are a bit ridiculous, actually, when you start looking at them.
I mean, if you just look at my bookshelves, there's no distinction. You know, if it sounds interesting and it sounds like it's got a good story and I'm going to enjoy it, I will read it. And it doesn't matter what it is.
But do you think, one distinction I can sort of see, but tell me if I'm wrong, is that I think in a lot of genre fiction or in particular genres, there are certain sort of... what's the word I'm looking for here? There are kind of conventions to it. So, for example, you know, when I interviewed Vara McFarlane, she talked me through the sort of conventions of romantic comedy. And I was going to ask you about crime fiction. You know, are there elements that a good crime thriller should probably be ticking off?
I guess so. I think it should be the same for any book. You know, you want a story that's going to propel you, compel you to keep turning the pages, and characters you identify with, and situations that are interesting. But yeah. I think like crime and thrillers just sort of ratchet that up, especially the whole thing about pace and stuff like that. Because if you didn't have like great characters and decent writing, people wouldn't read those books. You know, they would just be like, well, that's a bit naff. I couldn't engage with the characters. But you find that people who do read those sorts of genre fiction, they do identify with those characters, so much so that you have these long running series because people can't get enough of them.
Yeah.
So, you know, and I think it was Lee Child that once said, you know, I could write literary fiction if I wanted, but why use like really difficult words to tell a story when I can tell the same story with much better
words that everyone,
yeah, much easier to sort of understand and get my point across.
Yeah.
And you know, the plotting aspect, I think I heard a writer say somewhere who had tried to write a crime novel, and they just said, oh my god, this plotting is really hard.
God, yeah.
There's so much more to it. I mean, because you really have to think about the structure and the plot and then moving the characters around and how much information you give the reader and stuff like that. And it's hard work, you know. So it's not something, it is sort of looked down upon by certain people for certain reasons, but you know, it certainly shouldn't be. It's not for lack of really hard work and talent.
And so tell me a little bit about your sort of journey from there in terms of getting Brothers in Blood published.
That took a while. So when I'd written that first chapter back on that that course at Birkbeck, I'd heard about the Crime Writers Association, and they had a competition for unpublished writers called, you know, it was the Debut Dagger competition, but I'd never had anything that I felt I could enter it with. And and then when I wrote this first chapter on that course and it kind of worked, I thought, oh okay, I've got something, I can actually enter this competition. So I entered it, and really just to get my first rejection, because you know, I'd read Stephen King's On Writing and stuff like that, and you need to be prepared for rejection, and it's difficult. So I thought, well, let me just start. Let me enter. I know I'm going to get a rejection, so I can be prepared for it and, you know, just build up that thick skin.
So you just entered the first chapter?
Yeah, it was just the first chapter. So it was like 3,000 word limit or something. And so I entered that, forgot all about it. And then a few months later, I got a letter in the post to say that I'd been shortlisted. So, and I think that year was quite a big year for that award. I think there was sort of like 900 or 1,000 entries from all over the world. So I'd made the top 10 or something. And I was, wow. And that felt like such vindication as well, you know. Of
absolutely, yeah.
The writing is not pants then, perhaps. You know, perhaps that, you know, it's graduating a little bit. So that was really good. And I thought, oh, that's fantastic. Like more than I could have hoped for. And I thought, well, so when I eventually finish writing this novel and I'm submitting to agents, I can say, look, I was shortlisted for this award, you know, and that might just help me move up the slush pile a couple of places or something. So that was really good. And as part of being shortlisted, because the award ceremony was in London, so I was invited along on the night of the awards. So I went along, you know, to hobnob with best-selling authors. It was amazing. And, you know, it's free-course dinner and free-flowing wine. So I was just in my element. It was great. And then the Debut Dagger was the smallest of the awards, so it was the first one to be announced. And they read out the shortlist and they said, and the winner is, and it was me.
Oh,
I won the award. So, and it was, I was completely shocked because I just did not expect it. I, you know, when I entered that competition, I just thought, well, that's it. You know, I'll get my rejection, you know, and then move on to the next thing. But I won the award, which was just an amazing feeling. And the very next day, I was contacted by 4 agents, you know. And but the one thing they said is, "Oh, can we read the rest of the book?" And I'd only written 3 chapters at that point, so I was like, "Yeah, well, I haven't written it." And so 3 of the agents said, "Well, okay, when you finish it, send it to us." But one agent, who is now my agent, she said, "Well, okay, well, I want you to sign with me, and then when you finish it, send it to me."
Wow.
So it was a kind of exclusive.
So she was very convinced on the basis of that first chapter, yeah, that she was onto a winner with you.
Well, I'd like to think so, yeah. That's what I told myself and continue to tell myself.
Yeah.
So I signed with Jane Gregory, and then she said, right, well, you need to finish writing this book. How long is it going to take? And I had no idea. I thought, how long does it take to write a book? I've never actually written a book. I've just written, you know, short stories on weekends and stuff like that. And so I just sort of picked a sort of time out of my head. And I said, 6 months. And she didn't bat an eyelid. Every writer I've told since, they just kind of like, 6 months to write your first novel? Are you sure? But she must have thought, well, you know, if you can write a book in 6 months, that's 2 a year. That's a real money spinner.
Good client.
Yeah, great. So she didn't say anything. It was 5 years before I sent her a draft that I was happy with.
Were you in touch with her?
Yeah. I would get an email sort of once every 6 months or so saying, are you still alive? Are you still writing? How's it going? Do you need any help? You know, have you got anything for us to see? But I was very much, I didn't want anyone to see it until I felt it was ready, because I thought I might only have one shot. So I had to make it as good as I could. And so that, I think I did 5 complete rewrites of it. And so that it took 5 years, and then I sent it. I sent it in, and then I got the feedback was like, oh, you've done really well. You know, it's great setting, you know, really love the characters and some of the, and then the rest of this email just sort of said things that I needed to fix with it. There was sort of issues with it. And I, you
know, of course, as you would expect.
And I think I was, after 5 years, I was just pretty crestfallen. You know, that, oh my, it's not as perfect as I thought it was. And I sort of, I think I moped around for a few weeks, you know, maybe 3 or 4 weeks, but then started to think about the comments, and then started to think, okay, how do I address that? And I started to think of ways that I could improve. And then I just, you know, went back to it and started a rewrite, but with all those sort of things. And I think there was three or four or five main points, and I wrote them up and I stuck them on the wall so that as I was going back through the book, I would look and say, okay, am I addressing this issue? You know, one of them was like the motivate Zach, who's the main character of the book, his motivation wasn't strong enough in that draft. Like, why does he keep going down this path? It's dangerous. People are getting killed. Why does he not stop? So yeah, that took another year or so, because, you know, again, work and family and all that kind of stuff. And then it went back, and then it went through another edit, but that was just to tidy things up. So that wasn't massive, and I sort of did that quickly. And then I was waiting for the feedback. Would I need to do another round of edits? Was there still sort of things to fix? And I think I waited about sort of 8 weeks or something. I hadn't heard anything. And so then I got in touch with my agent, and she was away. And then somebody sort of, I had to wait for her to get back. And then she said, oh, it's gone out on submission to publishers. Didn't you know? Somebody should have told you. Like, yeah, it was fine. Yeah, we're just waiting to hear back.
Oh, my God.
I had no idea. But at that point, that's when all the rejections came in. Mm. So it went out to all the big publishing houses, all the crime imprints. It got rejected by every single one. Nobody wanted to pick up the book. And bear in mind, you know, it had won this award. And
You had a great agent.
Yeah, I had a great agent and a great editor, both of who were really, you know, excited about the book. They were really behind it. And they know what they're talking about. So that gave me a lot of confidence as well. And I was kind of sure, not in a big-headed way, but I felt really confident that it would get picked up. So, yeah, to get all those rejections was quite, you know, heartbreaking after 8 years of really putting in a lot of work. And I, you know, thought I'd done a good job with it. But I sort of, the feedback that I got from publishers, it was really confusing, because the feedback was all really positive. So they were saying it had great characters, a great setting, a great plot, great action, great dialogue. And I'm sort of scratching my head thinking, well, what more do you want in a crime thriller? It seems to have all those elements. It's ticking all the boxes. And yet they were still saying, no, but I just don't think we can publish it. You know, we don't have the right mission plan. It doesn't quite fit our list. And then one comment sort of was where the penny really dropped, where somebody said, I could never visualise it breaking out to appealing to a broad audience.
Right. So what they're getting at is that this is set in a British Asian community.
Yeah.
And they weren't sure white readers would read it.
Well, that was exactly it, reading between the lines, yeah. But it took me a while to sort of realise that.
Yeah.
But because nobody could come out and say, well, it's a bit too Asian. Because right. how would that sound? They didn't want to say that. So they found all these other sort of ways to to sort of put it.
Yeah.
But then I think then I kind of realized what it was. Yeah. The characters are all Asian because it's set in an Asian in the Asian community in the west of London. So in Southall. And there's a lot of Asian references. There's a bit of Asian language. But I'd been very conscious writing that book. I knew it was set in the Asian community. But first and foremost, it was a crime thriller for anybody who likes crime thrillers. It just happened that those characters are from that background. And so it plays a part. But it's like when you're cooking something and you add a bit of spice or you add a bit of chili, it's just there, you know, to lift it. And give it that something extra. Well, that's what I thought. But yeah, they just didn't think it would appeal to a broad audience. And I just thought they were wrong. And I thought, no, I don't believe that. Because as a reader myself, I know that I'm always looking out for something new and something different. If someone says, oh, this is unlike something you've read before, then I'm like, yeah, well, I want to know. I want to read it. And so I thought, no, I think readers will enjoy this, but it's not going to be published. And at that point I'd been hearing about self-publishing and stuff, and it's not anything I thought I would ever do, but I thought I want to get the book out there. I want to see for myself what people say, because if those publishers had said, look, the writing's not there, you know, maybe with the next book or something, then I would have just taken it and thought, okay, I'm not ready, you know, fair enough. But they hadn't. They'd said, no, this is all really good, but we're just not going to publish it. So I thought, okay, I'm going to publish it myself. I'm going to put it out there and I'll see what sort of reaction it gets. If it gets panned, then fair enough. You know, I will tail between my legs. I will slope off and write, you know, something different. So I sort of looked into the whole self-publishing thing. I spent 6 months on social media watching how all the big publishers launched their books. And so my background's in art. Like professional background is art and design, so I was designing all sorts of artwork and adverts and little posts for Twitter and Facebook and stuff like that. And I saw that publishers would send book bloggers the books to generate a little bit of a buzz before the book came out. So I learned how to typeset the book. I went and took photographs in Southall, designed my own cover, which is that's my self-published copy.
Wow. So yeah, it had a different name at this point, Western Fringes.
Yeah, that's what it won the debut Dagger under, because I just had to have a title. When
I really like your tagline, in Southall, finding a runaway girl can be murder.
Yeah, so
that
I thought,
is brilliant.
Thought all
that's
of that
not
up.
On the Brothers in Blood version, is
no,
it?
No.
That, I like it. They should have stuck with that.
But I even set up a fake publisher, so there's like a logo on the spine. So that when it's on a bookshelf,
it looks the same as all the others.
Legit,
yeah.
Yeah. So, and it's got, so I like designed the cover and it's got like copyright page.
That is a very professional effort.
Yeah.
It really is.
With all, you know, and so I sort of typeset the whole thing myself and everything. Got, you know, ISBN number, did the barcode myself.
Wow.
So it all looks very professional, and that's what I wanted to do. And one of my old bosses, I used to work for a print company. He set up his own company. He printed all my proof copies for me for free.
Oh, that's nice.
Which was really lovely of him. And so I contacted book bloggers and I sent them proof copies. You know, I've won the debut Dagger. I did my own press release. I pretended to be my own publicist as well and publisher. So I had these fake email addresses with job and sort of email signatures that said, you know, publicity department for this fake publisher.
I can see now how you come up with these plots for these books, because this is obviously very much you're a cunning man. Carry on.
and I did I did my own press release as well, and I would sort of, you know, contact book, and I would never, if somebody said they wouldn't review a self-published book, then I wouldn't approach them, and because I wasn't trying to fool anyone. But if they didn't specify, then I would just contact and say, look, I've got this crime novel, it won the debut Dagger. It's, you know, set in the Asian community in West London. You know, it's a thriller. Would you be interested? And, you know, I'd sort of formatted it for ebook as well. So it was available on sort of Amazon, Apple, Kobo and stuff like that. You know, I sorted all that myself. And so I would say, you know, do you want a physical copy? Would you like an ebook? And I would send it to them. And my boss used to let me use his postage as well because it was cheaper. So I'd go once a week, I'd go with a stack of proofs and I'd just post them out. And then the book bloggers were getting the book and they were reading it, and it was getting really, really good reviews. Like, I was getting like loads of 5-star reviews, and the people were saying, this is so different to anything that's on the bookshelves, and it's really and really pacey, and they really loved the whole Asian setting. They're like, well, you know, no one's done this before. And so it was really, I felt kind of vindicated, and I thought, well, obviously readers are enjoying it. So the publishers, you know, for all their reticence and thinking that this audience would not like it, they were wrong, because it was that broad audience that they didn't think they would like it, were the people who were reading it and enjoying it. And then the other thing that happened, I got these physical copies printed through Clays, who print for all the big publishers. I didn't want it to be print on demand. I wanted to control how the book looked. I wanted it to be a proper look and feel like a proper published novel. And so Clays said, oh, well, you know, you've printed the book with us. Would you like an account with Gardeners? Now, Gardeners are the big book suppliers who supply Waterstones and lots of bookshops all over the country. And I said, yeah, I would. I'd love an account with them. So they helped. They set the account up for me. And they said, oh, well, because then anyone can order it. So then I sent a copy to Waterstones head office with a letter and the press release. You know, would you like to take this book? Now, if they'd have taken it on as core stock, that means they buy it for every store, because, you know, it just goes to every store because that's what they think they should be selling. So all these big bestsellers, that's what happens. But obviously they'd never heard of me. They'd never heard of this dodgy publisher. They'd never heard of the book. And so I got this sort of polite email back saying, well, we're not going to take the book as core stock. You know, thank you for sending it to us. But it's on the system at Gardeners, so any shop that wants to order it can order it. So then I went to every bookshop in London, every Waterstones in London that I could get to with a copy of the book. Can I speak to the manager? Told the manager about the book, you know, set in London. And they were like, oh, they looked it up. Oh, it's on the system. Okay, we'll order 10 copies.
Oh, my God.
You know, we'll order 5 copies.
This is very impressive. So this was, little campaign you went on.
So it was getting into Waterstones. And also on Waterstones' website, they have the email address of every store in the country. So I was thinking, you know, Birmingham, Leicester, Coventry, they've got big Asian communities. Maybe they'd be interested in stocking a British Asian thriller. So I sent them an email with a PDF of the press release and just sort of, you know, from this publisher. And then, you know, it was getting ordered. It was in Edinburgh, Glasgow, Bradford, you know, Birmingham. It was being sold around the country. And then lots of small independent shops got behind it. They were ordering copies. And then I started to get reviews from readers on Amazon and stuff, and then people, I was getting emails through my website from readers, and it was just amazing, the response. You know, I mean one of the most sort of telling ones that really sort of stuck with me was and how did she say it? She said, I don't think I'm the target audience for this book because I'm white, female, over 40 and Scottish. And she said, but I absolutely loved it. And so I thought, yes, that's exactly who I want to enjoy the book. But I was still hustling the book around. So I'd go to festivals and things and, you know, just say to authors, because I thought, well, you know, if word can get out, if a famous author likes it and just tweets or mentions it, that could be massive for me. You know, so I'd sort of get chatting and say, oh, you know, would you like a copy of my book? And they'd sort of go, oh, no, not another one. But I'd say, oh, it won the debut Dagger. And that would kind of get my foot in the door. And they'd say, okay, all right, yeah, sure, we'll have a copy. And I remember Anne Cleves, I gave a copy to Anne Cleves. And I wasn't sure if she would read it, but she was on a book tour in Canada and she emailed me and she said, I really enjoyed it. I can't believe no one would publish it. You know, and so I was getting comments like that from well-known authors. And so I, you know, I just felt, all right, I'm doing the right thing. And so I thought it was going to be a long slog, that I would be, you know, my own publisher for a couple of years. And then I might get to a point where, it would work out, or I'd get a deal or whatever. And so I was touting the book at an event in at Waterstones in Piccadilly, and I was introduced to Charmaine Lovegrove, who had just set up Dialogue Books with Little Brown, and she was looking for the first few books they were going to put out. And so I told her about my book, and she was, oh, that sounds really good. Can you send it to me? So I sent her a PDF, and I think that was on a Thursday. And then on Monday, I got a phone call saying, could you come in for a meeting? And so I was like, well, I've been to meetings at publishers. I'm not holding my
breath.
You
don't get your hopes up. Yeah.
So I went in, and she was like, oh, my God, we loved it. You know, we thought it was great. It would be so good on our list, but you're already published with someone. You know, who is your publisher? And I said, well, you're looking at him. It's me. I've done it all from this room that we're talking in now. This is my publishing empire. And they said, oh, so there's no issues around copyright. I said, no, there's nothing. There's none of that. You know, I can sell it to whoever. And they said, well, okay, you know, we'd actually be really interested in taking it on. So, and then it got retitled, repackaged and republished. And when it did get published in 2018 as Brothers in Blood, then it just got really good reviews in all the national newspapers, and it went on to become a Times and Guardian, one of their thrillers of the year. Mm. So for a book that got turned down by every publisher, I felt,
do you know what?
Really,
well done.
Thank
like,
you.
I mean,
I felt
that work.
I felt so pleased, like so. It was just an amazing feeling then to have, especially have those big papers pick it as one of their books of the year. That was just phenomenal.
I mean, I think your experience sort of shows that writers of colour who are writing books that are set in their own communities, or books that are maybe a little bit outside of what the conventionally white world of publishing expects, are maybe not getting those opportunities that they should be getting.
I think that's very much the case. I just saw somebody posted on Twitter the other day, I can't remember who it was, but they said that writers are kind of getting turned down. If the books aren't as the publisher perceives people of those backgrounds, you know, how they imagine people of any kind of particular background to be. So, you know, if you're writing something, so mine was like very definitely a crime thriller, and the main characters, I mean, I wrote them so it wouldn't really matter what their background was. You could identify with them, and as most readers have. But there's all that sort of stuff. And I think if people have no experience of mixing with people from other backgrounds, if they've sort of lived in very kind of enclosed worlds, then they won't kind of get it. They'll have a kind of perception of, and I don't know where they will get that perception from if it's not through actually knowing people. So it's very kind of skewed. And they will think, well, I didn't know people like that were like that. So,
yeah.
And they think, well, is that right?
Yeah.
And then they kind of feel uncomfortable. And because it's outside of their experience, they don't think it's valid or something. So books are getting turned down if they don't conform to a kind of, I guess it's a stereotype that people have in their minds of how things should be. And that's just, I mean, I just think that's really silly as well. But to be fair, that's not the case with all publishers. And there are books that are getting published, which just goes to show that it depends who the gatekeepers are. You know, if you have somebody who has come up and sort of gone to a university or lived in a town where it's been very multicultural, and they know lots of people from lots of different backgrounds, and they just know, oh yeah, you know, somebody from that background could easily be doing this or that or the other. You know, there's nothing to stop them doing it. In fact, it makes it even more interesting because their experience will be completely different to my experience. And if I read that, then I will get an understanding. You know, my perceptions will grow, my worldview will increase. And
yeah.
So, yeah, that's happening more and more. But unfortunately, there are still people who kind of put barriers in the way of that happening. And I can't understand. I suppose I've been very sort of multicultural in my upbringing, the schools I went to and stuff like that. So it's never been an issue for me. So I kind of struggled to understand when things like that happen. And that's probably why I didn't see straight off the bat when my book was getting turned down. I didn't clock what the reason was. I was like, oh, I had to sort of scratch my head for a bit until the penny dropped. And then I was like, oh, all right, that's the reason.
Yeah, I think you're completely right. I think it is about where people have grown up and what they've been exposed to and whether they've... I think it's ignorance. It's just a sort of lack of knowledge of what's going on outside of their own bubble.
Yeah, and you think that readers are the sort of people who can live outside of their own experience and appreciate that and have greater empathy. But, I don't know. I can't explain. I honestly can't explain it, you know. It is down to... You know, I guess it's what they call unconscious bias, or maybe conscious absolutely. In some people's cases.
I really like the fact that you have in Brothers in Blood, you have bits of Punjabi scattered through the book. And I think it's quite clever the way you've done it, because you haven't you don't sort of translate what these people are saying. But it is, you know, from the I don't speak Punjabi, but from the context, I can figure out what the conversation
That's
is.
That's exactly,
you know?
How I did it. Yeah. So. I mean, even my own upbringing, like my mum will switch to Punjabi or when she's talking to me, and I'll reply in English because I'm more comfortable in English, and sometimes she's more comfortable in Punjabi.
Yeah, yeah.
But we communicate like that. And so I wanted to put that in the book. And so I have Zach, you know, maybe the characters that talk in Punjabi aren't, like, especially in the builder's yard where he's working. So people like Sid and...
Yeah,
and Mr. Bra, there's a lot of Punjabi from them, but Zach always responds in English. So you can kind of work out by his response what would have been said. Or yeah. If not exactly, you kind of get the gist of it. And when people are swearing in Punjabi, I think that's quite evident.
Yeah, yeah.
Just from what's
going
on.
Well, I felt like I picked up some vocab, to be honest.
I think you definitely did.
There's a lot of violence in your fiction, and that is, you know, very much in keeping with a crime thriller, what you would expect. I mean, there's a very unpleasant scene in Brothers in Blood in a butcher. There is,
yes,
torture essentially involving chili powder and lemon juice and some very unpleasant stuff going on.
Yes.
What is it like writing that? I mean, is it? Do you have a lot of fun doing that stuff?
Well, I think it's actually quite difficult to write that stuff. You have to really sort of get into those scenes. And especially, I mean, that torture scene especially. I think when I got to that, I mean, I kind of had an idea of what was going to happen, but it kind of took shape as I was writing it. And you're kind of in the heads of those characters. And I don't know, I guess because I was sort of seeing it in those terms, it didn't feel that shocking. And just those characters, the backgrounds and the sort of history they carry and the animosities they have, that would be something that would occur. And it wasn't like completely like far out and it kind of felt in keeping with the plot. So, and the fight scenes, I've read lots of good fight scenes, you know, and so I like doing the fight scenes. But to do the fight scenes, I would actually choreograph them.
I could tell that from where I was thinking you must have spent a lot of time thinking, right, if he goes in with a right hook here,
I did exactly that.
What's going to, you know, what's natural from there?
I acted the fights out from every participant's perspective and I wrote notes, and even things like, if he gets hit and he falls down, how long does it take for him to get back up? And then how would the other characters in that time, where would they have moved to? I mean, some people did comment, oh, there's way too much detail in the violence. But then I went through the book and looked at it. And actually, the fight scenes are actually really short. But I guess it just seems like there's a lot of information there because it all happens so quickly.
Yeah.
You know, well, hopefully people come away a little bit breathless. And
oh, yeah. And the poor guy's getting jumped on a daily basis.
Yeah, he's not having
book.
Much fun of it, is he? Getting beaten.
But how
and
many
battered.
Beatings can he take? Is there anything that you find particularly challenging as a writer?
The first draft is always really difficult for me. I find that such a slow grind. Even with a bit of a plan, I think it's just trying to formulate the words to kind of encapsulate the scenes and the story. I find editing a lot easier. I love the editing process. So once I get to the end of the first draft, then I kind of rub my hands and think, all right, now I can go over it, because I know then that I will hopefully just be able to improve what I've got. And to see that process of improvement is just really encouraging. And I get a lot from that, because I know that I'm, what I'm doing is making it better. But I think with the first draft, and I sort of really love that quote that's been attributed to Ernest Hemingway, who says the first draft of anything is going to be shit.
Yeah.
And he's right. I feel, or especially, you know, my writing is definitely, my first drafts definitely stick to that sort of. And, but I allow myself, I know it's going to be bad. But you write it down, and that's the thing. You know the first draft is not going to be good, but every subsequent draft is going to be better. So I think I get more kind of enthusiastic the further down the editing process I go. And then when I sent it, I mean, I've only done two books, but when I send it to the editor at my agents, I always look forward to getting her comments back, because I know that she will spot things that I haven't, and she would just kind of help me improve it even more. And it's that, I think it's that process of improvement. You kind of always, you feel like you're getting better as a writer. And I think for any writer, that you're always striving for that, to just to be that little bit better.
Can you think of anything specific that you've learned over the years that's really made a difference, whether it's a piece of advice that you got at Birkbeck or something that your agent said that's just clicked?
A piece of advice from Birkbeck. I think you're alluding to something I've mentioned before, which was having my dissertation eviscerated by my dissertation supervisor, who was the novelist Toby Litt.
And very nice guy, to be fair.
he's lovely. He is the loveliest person, but he was in Rottweiler mode on my dissertation, that just for that sort of 50 minutes of that hour that I had with him. And I came out of there feeling kind of like mentally and emotionally bruised. But to be fair, everything he said to me has stuck with me from then till now, and has really helped my writing, because I think that was the first time anyone had really sort of broken my writing down into, you know, is this paragraph, what's it doing? Is it doing what you want it to? Is it conveying the information you want? Does it have the pace that you want? Does it have character? And then going down to sentence construction. Is this sentence doing what you want it to? Could you combine this with another sentence to increase the pace of the book? And then down to individual word choice. Could you think of a better word to convey your meaning in this sentence? And I never really analysed it so closely. And then I remember when I was rewriting it, I just had his voice in my head saying, is this the right word? Is this sentence doing what it should? Could it be shorter? You know, is this, and that just helped my writing. I find that's a real skill if you can edit well, because your first draft is going to have lots of stuff that you probably don't need. And then going through when Brothers in Blood, when I first submitted it to my agent, and then I rewrote it, and then it went back to the editor, who went through, and then she sent me back two versions, two Word documents, and one had all the changes visible in track changes, and she sent me a clean version without anything marked on it. And she said, look, just read through the clean version, and if you're happy with it, you know, sign it off and we're good to go. But for my own benefit, I read the really marked up version in track changes, just so I could see what changes had been made. And it was so instructive just to see where, you know, she joined two sentences together and made it one, and it just how that had increased the pace. And she'd taken words out, and, you know, she'd taken like whole paragraphs out where I'd basically just been kind of repeating myself, and she would just take the nugget of information that she thought, well, this is what the reader needs to know, and the rest is kind of fluff, so you can get rid of it. Being able to take editorial feedback is very instructive. I mean, it can be painful, Don't get me wrong.
Oh, yeah.
You sort of sit there, lip quivering, thinking, don't cry, it's not that bad. But it's all useful stuff. It is very good and it all helps.
And looking back over your writing so far, and I'm sure there are a lot more books to come.
I hope so.
What do you feel the most proud of?
Well, both of the books equally, but for different reasons. I think the first one, it was such a slog to get it done, and I think because it was the first book, and I put so much of myself into it, into the writing, into the characters, into getting it out there, getting it published, and I'm very proud of that, and I think representing that Asian community in West London, and sort of getting it out there. And then when it was sort of picked up by a big publisher and it went on to be, like I said, picked as a thriller of the year, that was really special because it meant that this story did have some worth and those characters deserved to have their stories told. So, and if that, now I've been, contacted by a tutor who's teaching at a college of further education, and she says it's so difficult to get her kids to engage with writing, and they're from all sorts of different ethnic backgrounds, and so she's used the first chapter of my book and she said they've instantly kind of just got drawn in with it, and they're so interested and about the mechanics of the story, and they're really discussing it, and she said that's never happened before. But I think because people see themselves reflected in that story, and so there should be more stories like that. So I feel that if my, my book can do, more than just be a good read, if it can encourage other people to, want to tell their stories and show that they can do it and that it's valid for them to do that, then that's a hell of an accomplishment.
Huge thanks to Amar Anwar for that chat, which I enjoyed so much. His two novels are Brothers in Blood and Stone Cold Trouble, and you can find them in my shop on bookshop.org, alongside books by other guests of the podcast. That's at uk.bookshop.org/shop/in-writing, which I will also put in the show notes, and 10% of anything you spend there goes to independent bookshops, with another 10% going towards the making of this podcast. If you want to take your own writing to the next level, you can start your story today with my sponsor, Curtis Brown Creative. Use the code INWRITING20 for £20 off the short online writing course of your choice, and visit curtisbrowncreative.co.uk to find out more. If you enjoyed today's episode, please do subscribe, rate and review it, because that helps it find a larger audience. See you next week.